From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. What started in Minneapolis, protests over the murder of George Floyd in police custody, is reverberating around the world, from New Zealand to Brazil to Israel, Mexico, Turkey, Kenya, Japan, Canada. It might be simpler to list countries without protests. Hundreds of thousands of people are marching, expressing their rage over what happened to George Floyd and other people of color before him. Past demonstrations have been met with police force, in some cases more police brutality. But as protests continue night after night, we hear about different kinds of demonstrations, stories of a police chief and his officers having a dialogue with protesters. We've seen photos of officers taking a knee in solidarity with the protesters. Earlier this week, Governor Roy Cooper announced the creation of a new task force to address criminal justice reform to be led by Justice Anita Earls and Attorney General Josh Stein. In his remarks at that press briefing, Cooper said, "Too many people of color have been harassed, harmed, injured, or killed." He admitted that generations of historical trauma too often was inflicted by a criminal justice system that should protect people of color, but instead treats them unfairly. And Governor Cooper cited data that demonstrates communities of color are disproportionately affected at all stages of the criminal justice system. Joining me now to discuss the events of the last 2 weeks, Interim Chief of the Wilmington Police Department, Donnie Williams. Chief Williams, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Ed McMahon is sheriff in New Hanover County. Sheriff McMahon, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And Ben David is district attorney of New Hanover and Pender Counties, North Carolina's 6th District. Welcome, Ben David.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. What questions do you have for Chief Williams, Sheriff McMahon, or DA Ben David today? You can write to us during this live Thursday discussion via email at coastline@whqr.org. And I want to ask you first, Sheriff McMahon, when you look at the protests going on in downtown Wilmington, what do you see and how have they changed from perhaps that first protest during the last weekend of May to today? What do you see?
Well, I'm trying to watch, to learn. I see a lot of anger and voices that want to be heard. I think there's some confusion, and overall, people have been able to voice concerns they have, that what their realities are. And so I'm just trying to listen and to learn. And I mean, I encourage and welcome protests that are done orderly and follow the law.
Chief Donnie Williams, what do you see?
I see young people with a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm, and I see people that are committed to wanting to see change, not just at the local level, but at the national level. And I just see people wanting to exercise their right to be heard. And I just think if we're going to make changes, now is just a great time to harness that energy. And we all make the necessary changes together.
And we're going to talk about what some of those changes might be and what some of the changes are that are under discussion in cities across America, including in Washington, D.C. But Ben David, have you... what light bulbs have gone on for you, if any, from May 30th to today, June 11th?
Well, I'll back up the clock to May 24th. And seeing that video that the country's now seeing horrified all of us.
You're talking about the murder of George Floyd.
The murder of George Floyd and nothing less, and we should call it that. In terms of what I'm seeing now in the streets in my hometown, I love it. I love that people are active, not just online, but, you know, literally on the street. I think that represents the very best of our country when we get out there and do that. People should question authority. They should demand that we do better because we can do better. Many of us have been saying that for years. And I join with our governor, who was a four-term attorney general, in saying that there are needed criminal justice reforms. And so I'm very happy for this conversation. And I think particularly for someone like me who's used to talking, this last 2 weeks is really important to listen. And that's what I've done. I haven't had any public comments after initially calling for the curfew, because I think it's really important for us to listen and to hear what's going on and not pretend that we have all the answers, because it's complicated.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is for any of you. Have any of you gone out and talked to the protesters? Sorry, Chief Williams?
Yes, the actual Sunday night protest, I was actually out on the ground along with the sheriff. And when we were in the heat of the protest, I was out there talking with people. And after we got a better handle on things, the sheriff and I walked around downtown for hours talking with people. The following day, I was on a Zoom call with protesters. Later that day, I met with a community activist about what was going on in the community. And then the day after that, I met with another community leader that was heavily involved with the protest. So, yes, in the meetings and the conversations, they have been taking place.
Chief Williams, what did you hear from those conversations that you're taking to heart and thinking this could be one of the pillars of change?
People are concerned about whenever a law enforcement officer uses force. And that has been the big thing that I have heard, the use of force. And it's always been a controversial topic. And we have taken it to heart at Wilmington Police. One of the things that we're going to do is invite the public out to the Haynes Lacewell Police and Fire Training Facility. And we have a use of force simulator. And I want the public, and when I say the public, we can't allow all 121,000 citizens, but representatives of the public to go through the simulators. And after we're done with the simulator, I want to sit down with them and go through our use of force policy and see what can we change there or if we need to change anything. And the other big takeaway is officers intervening if they see behaviors that are not consistent. And we're in the process now, and it is a priority of writing a duty to act policy, meaning if one of our officers witnesses another law enforcement officer abusing a citizen, they have an obligation to put an end to the abuse.
Now that seems, coming from a layperson, like a challenge in itself because of the culture that has existed in law enforcement, you know, from the beginning, which we think of this as they take care of their own. How do you work against that dynamic that has been in place for so long?
We're going to have to educate people, and we're going to have to hold people accountable. As far as I'm concerned, there is no culture. The culture is doing what is right. And I'm hoping technology can also aid us in that with the use of body cameras, citizens having cell phone cameras. At the end of the day, if our people don't do the right thing for the right reason, we're going to hold them accountable for it.
Sheriff Ed McMahon, what have you heard from protesters that have triggered some new thoughts for you? I mean, where do you think your office can start to institute change?
I think the biggest thing for me was trying to wrap my mind around what is going on. I've been your sheriff for over 10 years now. We've been having difficult conversations. We've been through some highs, some lows, and I've been learning the whole time. And I was talking to a very good friend of mine, and you know, I'll just be blunt. He is a black male, and he was very upfront with me saying that there'll be things that I will never understand because I am not a black male. And he really helped me because he told me, stop looking at this with just New Hanover County, with these little short focus of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office, of Wilmington Police. So you need to look at it nationwide. You need to open up your mind and look at and try to understand the injustices that have taken place in other areas, not just here. And that was extremely helpful. That was just past week, and I had that conversation. It helped me wrap my mind. I want to be the best that I can be, and I want to protect our community. I want to be fair and just. We already have, in a, you know, we're a CLIA accredited, as is the Columbia Police Department. And you know, every year, every March for us, we look through all of our policies to see if we can do better, change anything, tweak anything. And we have in place already a duty. If an officer sees another deputy doing something wrong, he has a duty to report that. And we also have in there that you do not have to follow an unlawful, immoral, unethical order from a supervisor, and you report that immediately. So I think we always need to strive to get better, but I needed to open up my eyes and look broader than what I was looking.
We are also taking questions during this special edition of Coastline, and I have a question about a citizen review board with subpoena power or a citizen review board without subpoena power. First of all, Ben David, could you explain what a citizen review board looks like and whether or not you think it should have that power?
Sure. So when an officer commits a crime, we can put that in front of a grand jury, which is 18 members that look at a case. They can look at the videos, they can hear from the agents from usually the FBI or some outside investigation to determine whether a crime's been committed. And if 12 of the 18 say that a crime has been committed, there's an indictment. That has been our citizens review board for years. What this is seeking to do is go a little further. It says, in addition to crimes, how about things that fall maybe short of that standard, but nonetheless call into question the officer's credibility or bias? We have a policy in place that does that. It's called the Giglio policy, which is named for a Supreme Court case that requires disclosure to the defendant and to the court of officers who are like that. And certainly in the George Floyd case, there's all sorts of evidence that that officer should have been stripped of his badge years earlier. So to answer your question directly, Rachel, yes, I support looking at whether we should create a citizens review board here. I've already taken the step to ask my first assistant DA to reach out to other criminal justice stakeholders, public defender's office, private attorneys, judges, people who are in the city and county government, to take a look at what that would look like here. There's other communities that have done that. And we are looking, obviously, for best practices.
With or without subpoena power? Is that...
Again,
you know what?
What shape it particularly takes will be dependent a little bit on what works in those other places. I want to talk to district attorneys like my good friend Spencer Merriweather, who's the DA in Charlotte, who has that.
Okay, and we can pick this up when we come back. You're listening to Coastline. It's a special Thursday edition with District Attorney Ben David, Wilmington Police Chief Donnie Williams, New Hanover County Sheriff Ed McMahon. You can ask your own question during the live Thursday discussion by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. When we return from the short break, we'll hear more from listeners. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Protests over the death of George Floyd are taking place nightly in downtown Wilmington and around the world. New Hanover County Sheriff Ed McMahon, Wilmington Interim Police Chief Donnie Williams, and District Attorney Ben David are with us today and answering your questions. You can send them during the live Thursday discussion to coastline@whqr.org. And Ben, just before we went to break, I did what I promised you I would do and ask you a question you couldn't fully answer. We were talking about a citizen review board. You talked about getting input from members of the community across different sectors. Whether there will be subpoena power for a citizen review board, is that an open question? Is that what you were explaining?
Yes. I will do whatever I think is the most effective way to show there's transparency and that we all move towards the same thing, which is the truth. And so I would be open to that. I have evolved in my thinking from believing grand juries were sufficient by themselves with our Giglio policy, which we've long had, to ensuring the public that I represent that we are doing all those things. And if we need the oversight of a citizens review board, I'd be willing to have that conversation, and I'm looking for the best ways to do that. What form it takes, I think, is beyond just me, because I believe it needs to come from the whole Community Justice Advisory Council, what we call the CJAC. And that was the group I addressed a week ago to say that we need to convene a group to start doing this. And that's where we are right now.
We have an email from Tristan who asks, have you relied on the legal precedent of qualified immunity to protect your officers? Why was it necessary? How would your life change if the qualified immunity precedents were removed? And of course, this is a question that we've heard discussion about now around the country and in Washington. So first of all, Ben David, what does qualified immunity for officers mean? And why has it been in place up to now?
It basically says those who are serving in an official government setting should not be sued individually and subject their own personal assets, like their home and their car and their personal wealth, to losing that in the performance of their official duties. Who would want to be an officer or a prosecutor if that was the case? And while everyone is committed to doing the right thing, we're humans and we make mistakes. So you should really only lose that if there's intentional conduct, like we've seen in the George Floyd case. So that's the idea, at least conceptually, behind qualified immunity.
And has it been used in this here in your district?
I don't know if there have been officers who have been embroiled in use of force cases who have been sued after the fact, and they were provided counsel, and they've had large sums paid out on behalf of the citizens through either the county or the city. So that, to answer your question directly, yes, that has happened through the years.
We have a question from Deborah Dix Maxwell, who's president of the New Hanover County NAACP, and this is for you, Sheriff McMahon. She asks, will you use your position as an officer in the North Carolina Sheriff Association to assist in moving the request of protesters moving forward statewide? Sheriff Ingram was requested to forward information to all members of the association.
Okay, I'm not quite sure I understand that. Will I use my position in the association to encourage protesting to be allowed?
Moving the requests of protesters moving forward. And I'm not sure exactly what that means, but she says Sheriff Ingram was asked to forward information to all members of the association.
And it would be Sheriff Ingram is our president right now. I'm second vice president. So, I mean, we have conversations. I'm not really sure what that means, but I am in favor of people protesting as long as they do it peaceably and in order. Everyone that I know of on the Sheriff Association is also in favor of peaceful protests. Not really sure what that means, but I'm definitely in favor of that.
Okay. And a question for Chief Williams from Tony. He says, on June 4th, a citizen was filming a WPD team in full riot gear moving into position near protesters. One of the officers gave the order to terminate body cameras. When the person filming yelled that was illegal, an officer responded with, quote, no, it's not. He says, my question is this. While it may be legal for police to turn off body cameras before engaging with citizens, does that defeat the purpose of having them? Why are we paying for them? What kind of message do you think that sends? Chief Williams?
Yes, there's more to the story with that case. One thing with our body cameras, they are on recording all the time, even when they're in standby mode. Once the officer hits the record button, it actually starts to save the video. This particular group of officers were done for the night, and they were actually walking back to the station area. So the command was given for them to terminate, meaning stop recording. The body cameras were still on. When our officers are out in the field, they don't ride around with the cameras recording all the time during the entire shift. And there's one of the big reasons why is it would just create so much couldn't manage all those terabytes of data. So they, again, they were given that command to terminate the videos because they were going back to the staging area to get out of the gear for the night. And they were walking away from the protesters.
Okay, we have a question from Greg, who writes, what impact do the riots of 1898 have on today's Black community? And he's, of course, talking about the only recorded coup d'etat in American history that took place in Wilmington, North Carolina, when a cabal of white people forced duly elected officials, Black officials, out of government. They forced people from their homes. We still don't know the death toll from that day in 1898. But Ben David, you have talked quite a bit about Wilmington's history. So part of this is, I mean, George Floyd is the most recent public event that triggered the discussion. But this area has had these discussions for a long time. How do you think that 1898 shapes our interpretation of George Floyd?
Sure. Well, it's no accident that we held our peace rally for law enforcement and justice officials in front of the 1898 memorial. Our history shapes us, and we need to understand that history if we don't want to repeat it. And one thing that we did there and we're very intentional about is really giving credit to the community, not just to law enforcement, about why we weren't having looting and rioting and violence in the streets of Wilmington. I give tremendous credit to the established leaders, the faith leaders who were there. People like Deborah Dix Maxwell, who just wrote in, I complimented her, not just to the North Carolina president of the NAACP, but to her personally this past weekend. I think it's important that we remember that the pain of 1898 is something that is well documented. What's not as well known is the greatness of 1897, where Black and white people came together in a Jim Crow South to do something great. They created a fusion movement that was so politically powerful that it not only captured the governor's mansion, but both US Senate seats and a lot of city hall seats where Black and white elected officials existed. It was way ahead of its time. We need to get back to 1897 and not just dwell on 1898. The DNA of our city is one that's progressive, inclusive, and we need to honor that history. And that is what I think we are doing when we move forward together to create community and fight against chaos.
But when we think about the divide that exists, that, you know, certainly we at WHQR have been talking about for years and always trying to find a way into this conversation. This is a segregated region. And the Black community, as I understand it, is not growing in size here. It's shrinking partly due to people retiring to this area for the beaches and moving here, white affluent retirees, partly because people of color who grow up here choose not to stay. And so, yes, 1897 was an extremely progressive time in the history of Wilmington, North Carolina, but 1898 informs that divide today. It has an influence on it. Can you unpack?
We call it, yes, Rachel, I agree. We shouldn't run from that past. We should recognize that it has really shaped this region economically, housing patterns, where kids go to school because of it. It is shaped who hangs out with whom. And I think that's a really important thing that we understand that. That's why I started a class 10 years ago called The History of Wilmington in Black and White, where we specifically introduced public educators and police officers to not just the 1898, but the Wilmington 10, the fact that Dr. King was supposed to be here on the night he was murdered in Memphis. Because the more that we understand our history, the more that we can understand why we are in where we are now and what we can do moving forward together.
So in the way that hospitals and, you know, New Hanover Regional Medical Center, for instance, created a position to start addressing the social determinants of health, like really instead of just treating disease, they're looking at how can we close that gap in outcomes when it comes to health disparities. Is that a conversation we should be having in terms of public safety? What about the social determinants of public safety? Sheriff McMahon.
Well, absolutely. I think, and like I say, I'm listening and I'm learning, and if the things that we can do to make us better, then, you know, I'm all in.
We know that New York, Chicago, Los Angeles city officials are planning to cut funding for their police departments. Winston-Salem in North Carolina is taking money out of the police budget to put into poverty reduction programs. Are there functions that you, and this is for Chief Williams or Sheriff McMahon, as law enforcement officials would like to see taken off your hands? Are there ways, productive, constructive ways that could happen here?
I would be open to having the conversation, but I think we would need to look at how this could work with our operation. Because keep in mind, law enforcement is a 24-hour-a-day, 365-day-a-year operation. And I wouldn't want us to say we're not doing this, and then it happens when the agency that's supposed to be doing it is unavailable. So definitely would be open to it, but I think there needs to be some further analysis to see what we could actually give up and divert the other organizations.
Sheriff McMahon?
Sure. Every year, my commissioners, our commissioners, hold me accountable and through the manager's office. So we look through every line item every year of our budget. And I have to justify, what do I need? Did I get more than what I needed? And I can tell you that's a no. And look at, does it need to be enforcement? Does it need to be something else? And I have those conversations individually with the commissioners, with the manager's office. So we are doing that every year now.
Ben David, from where you sit, can you look at some of the functions that have been kind of perhaps foisted on law enforcement by default, because they're the ones who have to show up and deal with it, that could be taken off the plate of law enforcement officials and put somewhere else, which would include rearranging funding?
Absolutely. And I think that's the key word. It's not defunding the police, it's refunding the police. It's saying, what functions are they doing now that could go somewhere else? For instance, the opioid epidemic. We created a quick response team where people who get immunity under the law for getting back to life when they are having an overdose, have a team meet with them of social workers, people who have a lived experience, and make that a medical issue. Right now we've given Narcan kits to police officers. We're asking them to do more than ever before. You know, mental health and a lot of what we see can really be in tandem with different professionals in health. And that's why I've said that the social determinants of health are the same as the root causes of crime. I was asked to give a TED talk this time last year about it. I thank you for linking to that, because what it really shows us is we go to the areas of greatest need, and we need a collaborative working approach to do that. That doesn't mean we need to stop the police function. We just need to reimagine warrior to guardian, where you're going to the areas of greatest need and say, we're not here to be an occupying force. We're here to make sure that justice occurs in a place where these high crime areas are also high victim areas. That's what we're talking about when we're saying deploying the right assets to the community. We're not saying to get away from policing, but just to do it in a way that honors that mindset shift from warrior to guardian.
And Bill asks, do the recruiting policies of police and sheriff's departments play a role in attracting a personality type predisposed toward a more force-oriented form of policing? And he says, if so, would you consider changing those policies to attract a different sort of personality type to become a police officer? You know, there's a whole other conversation that we need to have, not today, about some of the folks who are public servants who are doing really good work in law enforcement. That's not our focus today, but I do want to acknowledge that. I think, anyway.
I think real quick, if you want a quick answer from me, we do a psychological evaluation. We have a nationally renowned company do that on every officer, every deputy, before we even hire, part of our hiring process, along with polygraph and in-depth background checks. So we're trying to catch it early.
And the same with the Wilmington Police Department. We go through an extensive vetting process, but one of the most difficult things is, how do you judge a person's heart that they really want to get in this work to do it for the right reason. And I think that's why law enforcement officers, law enforcement agencies across the country is sometimes struggling with the misconduct issue, because how do you judge a person's heart?
Yeah. And we have an email from Eden. I'm probably going to get a chance to read this and ask this question. We might need to go to break soon. But accountability and transparency, Eden writes, are crucial. Question for DA David about the outstanding case in Pender County where a black teen and his mother were threatened at their own doorstep by a group of armed white men. She says, I listened to the DA's press conference and frankly was dismayed he wasn't willing to state clearly that our community will not tolerate armed groups of citizens trying to take the law into their own hands. It was a travesty. The family did not receive justice that night. He seems to be valuing the Second Amendment rights of the perpetrators over the safety of the victims. And despite the rhetoric, we must be clear that if this black teen had showed up armed on a white family's doorstep, history shows that the law enforcement would likely have acted very differently. She says, I know charges were brought forward for the deputy and one other armed perpetrator, but why wasn't this done immediately? Have arrests been made? Are charges for the other armed trespassers being considered?
I stand by everything I said, and you can go online and look at the entirety of the press conference. In terms of why it took some time, we regard it so seriously when an officer is accused of criminal conduct that we demand a full investigation. Sheriff McMahon, whose deputy was involved, who was in a different county at the time, was immediately notified, and he took the what I believe is the appropriate disciplinary action in that case. In terms of why it took as long as it did, we wanted to make sure an investigation was done. And frankly, it was complicated by the fact that it was put into the press while that investigation was still ongoing. It was much harder and has remained harder to get people to talk when they know they're on the not only the cover of our local press, but literally on international press. And so that's why we don't try cases in the press. We can talk about the process, but not the facts. The facts will come out in a courtroom. I absolutely say that it is not okay for anybody to take law into their own hands. That's the very worst type of thing that can be done. And as there is a Second Amendment, I was very clear on saying that did not apply in this case under the facts that we had, and we criminally charged two people as a result. So I just implore people to watch that case as it develops, and we'll do our talking in the courtroom here forward.
And where is the next step in that case?
In a courtroom.
Criminally charged.
Well, because of COVID, I mean, it was set on a calendar for this week, but because of the COVID restrictions, We've had to push back all court functions. It's not just this case. And so I don't know if there's been a new date set yet, but it's obviously a priority case for us in Pender County.
You're listening to Coastline. We are doing a special Thursday edition with Wilmington Police Chief Donnie Williams, District Attorney Ben David, New Hanover County Sheriff Ed McMahon. You can ask your own question during the live Thursday discussion by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. When we return from this short break, we'll hear more from listeners. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Protests over George Floyd's death take place nightly in Wilmington and around the world. New Hanover County Sheriff Ed McMahon, Wilmington Interim Police Chief Donnie Williams, and District Attorney Ben David are with us today to examine the questions that have arisen and continue to arise from those protests. You can send your own question in during the live Thursday discussion to coastline@whqr.org. And I will get to some more listener questions, but this was sent in from an Ollie student who took your class, Ben David. And I think this is a question that a lot of people have probably asked. He writes, I strongly feel that George Floyd would be alive today If some citizen on the street at the scene of the incident had taken the right nonviolent action to interrupt the chain of events. He says, I have children and college-age grandchildren that I would like to direct toward that appropriate citizen's action should they innocently become involved in a similar situation. What could bystanders have done? And Ben, I'll give it to you first since he took your class, but I think Sheriff McMahon and Chief Williams should weigh in on this as well.
Number one thing that a citizen can do when they see a crime is to call 911, and there should be an immediate response. It wouldn't have taken 8 minutes and 46 seconds for police to respond, and they have a duty to intervene. There's a duty to act under the law, and Chief Williams was just talking a little bit earlier about that. They should also film it. We want transparency. It can help with evidence later. As for whether any arrest is made, that would be an outside investigation conducted by usually State Bureau of Investigation agents or an outside agency that don't have ties to the investigated agency. And so we seek to protect that identity. That's why we don't release SBI reports and take great pains to make sure that witnesses that come forward on these tough cases are protected. We obviously have to disclose their identities if there's a trial because there's a Sixth Amendment right to confront accusers, but we do everything we can to make sure that that information is immediately captured. And if you still have an ability to help somebody, you know, call 911 and try to help yourself if you can without obviously creating a dangerous situation.
Chief Williams?
Yes, I want to echo what the DA said. In those circumstances, if a citizen observes one of our employees doing something inappropriate, they can actually call 911 and request a supervisor respond to the scene. I would encourage them to videotape. And if it's something that doesn't need immediate intervention, we have a complaint/commendation process. You can complain by phone. You can do it by email. You can do it in person. We want to take complaints. We want to improve and make our agency better. And actually, prior to all of the protesting and everything taking place, we're in the process of looking at bringing on a person to do customer service follow-ups. And this would be an employee that is not located in the police department. I don't want them in the station. I don't want them to know any of our employees. I just want them to be able to reach out to citizens after we've responded to a service call to tell us how we did. But we can seek to improve our service delivery to the public.
And what would the name of that position, that created position be?
It would be some type of customer service manager. We're looking at doing it through a temp position to start out. And if it has a success rate that we're thinking it may have, then we'll look at maybe converting a full-time position next budget year.
Sheriff Ed McMahon, is there a circumstance under which, you know, in George Floyd's case, he had 8 minutes, a little more. Is there a circumstance in which a citizen could reasonably tackle a police officer or intervene somehow to save someone's life?
I agree with what Ben and Chief Donnie said. I don't think we can try to shift the blame. This was bad officers acting badly. And I know if my son had been watching, I don't think I would want him trying to intervene when bad officers are actually killing somebody in front of your own eyes. And you intervene, what's going to happen to you? So I think the citizens there, I believe they may have called 911. That's a great idea. And video. That was outrageous. And I don't know what a citizen could do without jeopardizing when you have officers doing that type of heinous activity. I don't know what a citizen could do to intervene without themselves putting themselves in serious danger.
Yeah. We have a question from Leah. She says, can we start hiring police and employ them in neighborhoods where demographics match the race of officers in our communities, as well as develop community policing so communities know the officers policing them rather than have officers who are there solely to police? It's residents without knowledge or history of the community they're supposed to be protecting and serving. Chief Williams.
Yes, we're not going to deploy people based on their race. We're not going to do that. We're going to deploy people based on the needs of the community. And I just think you're going down a dangerous path when we put, say, black officers in black neighborhoods and we put white officers in white neighborhoods. We should put them in there because they're trained, they're qualified, and they can do the work at hand.
What about
as far as community?
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, community, sir.
People will sometimes lump community policing and community engagement in together and get the two of them confused. Community policing is an agency-wide philosophy where the police, the community, and government work together proactively to solve problems. Community engagement is when you see the officers out on foot, the bicycles, the community involvement programs. And I think I can speak for both myself and Sheriff McMahon. We have gone above and beyond, and we will continue to do more when it comes to community engagement. One of our biggest hurdles has been the past 2 months. We've had to pull back a lot of that stuff because of COVID-19. The sheriff has his elements program. We have our PAL program. We do cop camp. He does say summer. We do Santa cop. And the list just goes on and on and on with our engagement efforts to make ourselves known to the community. And we do try to put the same officers in the same neighborhoods, but you'll have people that will advance in their career. We'll have people that are on patrol that may want to become a detective. Well, we can't leave that officer in that neighborhood for forever, so we want them to grow. You'll have people that'll get promoted, which causes us to pull them out of the neighborhoods. But we are opening and sitting down with the community and listening and working through all this stuff together.
Ben David, you've talked about stepping up patrols in high poverty, high minority neighborhoods, and locating police substations near them. So, you know, your logic is, if it seems like the police are part of that community, it'll be less of an adversarial relationship with the community. But one local scholar pointed out to me recently that new police headquarters going up across from a black community could be perceived as threatening, and we're watching you and we're going to take care of you, not necessarily friendly protection. Can you see that?
Can see how that perception is out there. And I think that's why education is so important. They're referring to the substation that was just built across the street from Creekwood. Go in there. You'll see that there's this shoot, don't shoot scenario that Chief Williams talked about earlier that all of my prosecutors have gone through. You'll see that there is a community outreach effort that is sincere in trying to bring the young kids into there to say, we want you to respect authority, not fear power. If what we're really talking about is community policing and community-based prosecution in the very best way, people should want to be neighbors with the police. It's only when we're, I think, doing it wrong, and clearly what they did in Minneapolis was wrong, that you have something that makes it look like they're at war with the communities you serve. We're trying to change how that view is out there, and that's been something that's been ongoing for years. I think we'd be going in the wrong direction to pull out of the areas of greatest need. You saw that happen after what they called the Ferguson effect, the blue flu, where people left. And in 25 major metro areas across the country, the murder rate spiked. That is not the answer. The answer is to double down and help the people living in high poverty areas. They need and demand justice, and they get it best when we are there to serve them.
We have a question from Roy who says, he heard a police officer talking about ways to reduce police work. He says, I would ask why the police all need to have guns and why do they think they are not civilians? It seems if the police are looking for less work to do, they can stop the difficult situation of thinking of themselves as warriors or guardians or something other than our neighbors and members of the same community. Roy says they should be exactly as willing to help all members of their community as I am, because I too am a civilian very willing to help. Is there a shift in just thinking about the job, Sheriff McMahon, that you can see occurring here?
Again, I'm listening, but we, the majority of the time, your law enforcement are guardians. Any officer I've ever interviewed that come in, and why do you want to come in? We want to make a difference. We want to help our community be safe. So retiring, you look back at your career, did I make a difference? Did I help keep my neighborhood safe? Well, we are citizens. We are part of our community. I mean, I have grandchildren at go to the schools here. They, you know, we play soccer, baseball, basketball, go to the skate park. We're, you know, I'm Papa, I'm a grandfather, I'm a husband, I'm a father. So I'm part of the community. And the role that I play the majority of the time is a guardian. You have to, you know what? I'd love it if we didn't have to have a gun, if we didn't have to have all the things we have to have, but we have to have that because there are people out there that want to hurt not only us, but want to hurt other people. So it's part of being the role that we have as law enforcement. But we all, if you ask any policeman, any deputy, we got in this thing to help, and we are part of the community.
We have an email from Heidi who says, when I moved here from Maryland, one time in the neighborhood, I saw something to report to non-emergency police. First thing I was asked if I was black or white. I asked for her supervisor. He asked the same thing. Maybe it had to do with my accent. I said, if I am black, you are not sending police. Here is the address and go investigate. That wasn't the first so far experience with police here. Chief Williams, any comment on that?
Well, I would want to know more about the incident. Who did she call? Did she call the front desk at the police department, or did she call the 911 center directly? So before I comment on it, I would encourage her to call my office at 910-343-3610. And if she could provide us with more information, I would be glad to look into it and give her an explanation. But I just want to know more facts behind it.
Okay. And quickly, you know, Ben David, you've talked about not shooting the messenger, meaning you're the one holding up a mirror to the community that sometimes people might not want to see. But are there miscarriages of justice based on who the messenger is? What have you learned about how implicit bias can play into the miscarriage of justice since you've been a prosecutor?
There's no question that there is structural inequality in America, and that shows up in every sector, whether it's at our hospital, at our schools, or at the courthouse. And so this is a time for great introspection for all of us, not just any one of us. Yes, it's definitely the case where we need to do a better job of educating on what implicit bias is, to deal with de-escalation training, to make sure that everyone, you know, lives under the standard of equal protection, which is something we not only have in our Constitution, but take an oath to uphold every day. It is not a binary choice to say you believe that Black Lives Matter, as I've said for years, but to also say you love and support the police and want what's best for them. Michael Jordan gave $2 million at the height of violence 4 years ago. He gave $1 million to the Policeman's Benevolent Association, and he gave $1 million to the NAACP. That's because his father was murdered, and he understood that you need good people when that happens. But he's also saying it's not, the status quo is not okay. And that's what I say today as well.
And what do we know about how implicit bias shapes how we function here? Can we take this out of the theoretical national discussion and say, this needs to change? Here's this component that we can work on.
Well, it takes many forms. It works on a subconscious level. So people aren't even aware of it. It's not overt racism. It's they have word associations where they feel a certain way about one race versus another, a certain about one type of nationality versus another. And that's something that all of us need to educate ourselves and guard ourselves against. That an unarmed black man is 2.5 times more likely to be shot than an unarmed white man is what we're talking about. It's just one small example.
That man, that's
a baby born today in America is 40 times more likely to be murdered one day if they're black than if they're white.
We are out of time. This is a difficult conversation that is impossible to contain in 50 minutes, but I appreciate all of you. District Attorney Ben David, Sheriff Ed McMahon, Police Chief Donnie Williams, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Rachel
Keith
is producer of Coastline. Ken Campbell is technical director. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org at the podcast or find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.